And you're listening to Norman Otis Richmond and Dr. Gerald Horn, and this is the Horn Report. How are you doing today, my good friend?
Fine, and yourself?
Oh, everything is good. I guess the first question I want to ask you is, we missed the first 100 days, but I would like to get your assessment of President Barack Obama so far.
Well, it's a mixed evaluation, quite frankly. On the one hand, if you look at the current U.S. president in comparison and relative to his predecessors, obviously he stands head and shoulders above the rest. But as we know, since his predecessors have mostly been moral and are intellectual dwarfs, that's not necessarily the best barometer. On the one hand, you see him domestically trying to move against discrimination against women in the workplace. You see him trying to protect women's right to choose in terms of reproductive choices. On the other hand, if you look in the international arena, you see that 17,000 more U.S. troops have been committed to this war in Afghanistan that could not be won. You also see him giving a speech in Cairo on June 4th, 2009, Thursday, which also reflected that kind of mixed evaluation. On the one hand, there was soaring rhetoric with regard to how Palestinians have suffered and how settlements in occupied territories need to be removed by Israel. On the other hand, the soaring rhetoric, for the most part, did not go so far as to come forward with solid and concrete policy proposals. So the bottom line is that Mr. Obama gets a grade of incomplete thus far.
Okay, let me ask you, could you elaborate on his speech in Cairo? And the second part of that question is that, you know, due to the whole question of public opinion and the fact that, you know, many people have basically said that capitalism is finished, do you think it's a good time for the progressive left or anybody to raise raise socialism as an alternative to the current situation?
Well, if we don't raise the idea of socialism now, I don't know when we ever will raise the question. Obviously, capitalism is in free fall. You see a wave of devastation coursing throughout the capitalist world, not least in North America. The bankruptcy of General Motors, the bankruptcy of Chrysler, both have hit both the United States and Canada quite hard. It seems to me that with tax dollars, our hard-earned tax dollars, going into the pockets of bank barons, banksters, to use a phrase that's currently prominent, it seems to me rather than pouring money into their pockets, we should be thinking about a socialist project whereby our tax dollars can be used for the public good and for the Commonwealth as a whole. Now, with regard to Mr. Obama's speech in Cairo, once again, it was a mixed message. On the positive side, I have to say that I was rather pleased that he began his speech by criticizing the way U.S. imperialism manipulated or sought to manipulate the Muslim and Arab world during the Cold War. We all know how that went down in Afghanistan, whereby there was a kind of crusade, if I can coin a phrase, where Muslims and Arabs from around the world poured into Afghanistan to destabilize a rather progressive regime in Kabul. And that, of course, led to the rise of Osama bin Laden, which led directly to September 11, 2001, and 3,000 U.S. and other nationals being slaughtered. Now, despite these clear connections, there is a reluctance in the United States to say anything negative about the Cold War against the Soviet Union. It's amazing. I mean, the Soviet Union has been out of business for a decade and a half or more, and yet there still seems to be a moratorium, if you like, in terms of criticizing those policies, such as the war in Afghanistan, that led to its downfall. Now, Mr. Obama, in his opening remarks, basically made a criticism of that policy and the devastation that it's caused, not least in the Arab and Muslim world. But to repeat, with regard to concrete policy proposals to get us out of the present hole that we find ourselves in, I'm speaking with regard to the war in Afghanistan, I'm speaking with regard to the illegal Israeli occupation of Arab and Palestinian lands, there was more rhetoric than substance. But on the other hand, I think that in the international community as a whole, and from preliminary readings, generally speaking, in the part of the world from which Mr. Obama gave his remarks, there was a positive note sounded, probably because they were comparing him to his predecessor, one George W. Bush.
Do you think that was the first time an American president ever said "Assalamu alaikum" in public? Is that?
It's possible. I have to say, I was struck by the use of that phrase myself. Obviously, it's a phrase that's commonly used amongst black people in North America, given the prominence of Islam in our community and the Nation of Islam in particular. And Mr. Obama, with roots in Chicago, he's certainly familiar with the Nation of Islam, which is headquartered in Chicago. He's probably heard that phrase more than once, probably used it more than once before he got to Washington. So that was rather striking, I must say.
Now let's talk about the Canadian elections. What have you heard, if anything, about the Canadian elections from, you know, your following of the press? It looks as if, what's his name, is threatening Mr. Our good friend Iggy. Mr. Inatieff. I had a battle with Mr. Inatieff publicly, but I'll talk about that later. The Canadian elections, how much of a airplay has that received, or print media has that received in the United States?
Well, I would say so far, not that much. Quite frankly, I have to say that the choices, from my point of view at least, between Mr. Harper and Mr. Ignatieff is not appetizing, to put it mildly. On the other hand, you should know that the Washington Times, which is a conservative daily based in Washington, D.C., owned by the Unification Church of Reverend Sun Myung Moon of South Korea, the Republic of Korea, have a devastating attack on Mr. Jack Layton of the NDP just the other day.
He's coming to Washington, or he is in Washington, right?
Yes, exactly. And they were basically trying to red bait the Democratic Party, which basically or apparently opened their arms to Mr. Layton. And the headline was something like, you know, dangerous socialists from Canada and Washington embracing the Democrats. And so that gives you an idea of the backwardness of the political scene in the nation's capital.
Well, Mr. Inatieff had a book launch about three or four Friday nights ago, and I attended, and I asked him a question about the question of he talked about Africa, and he didn't talk about Africa, the Caribbean. And I asked him about what did he think about the fact that Muammar Gaddafi, who is the new head of the African Union, wanting to bring in the African Union and supporting being the head of the African Union and putting people from the Caribbean in the African Union. And I pointed out that since black Americans were free, now that they had Obama, they would not be part of this project. And he laughed when I mentioned the fact that Gaddafi, and he went on to attack Mugabe, of course, and said he wouldn't give Mugabe a dime, and talked about Darfur and talked about the role, the progressive role, and the fact that Canadians freed Namibia. Being the historian that you are, I think that's probably the first time you heard that in terms of you never probably read or heard that anywhere, have you?
That's news to me. I'll have to look at his footnotes on that one.
But needless to say, I'm not saying that I'm such a great debater, but I really put him on the spot, and he talked about Jean Augustine, whose job he took. She's a Grenadian sister who they parachuted him in to take her role, and she has a seat at York University, or she has a department here, which where we're doing this interview from. But and Mr. Inatieff is, he might unfortunately become the next prime minister of this country.
Well, that would be disappointing, particularly given his deep roots in the United States. As I said, he's the Massachusetts candidate, a play on words of the Manchurian candidate, if you recall that particular novel and film. But, Norman, as you know, I just watched about a six-hour documentary on your late Prime Minister, Pierre Trudeau.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say that Mr. Trudeau, comparing him to Mr. Ignatieff, it seems that Canada is taking a great leap backwards. I should also mention that Mr. Trudeau and the Trudeau mania that greeted his initial election in the late 1960s, in some ways is reminiscent of what happened with Mr. Obama. Keep in mind that these are analogous candidates. Mr. Trudeau carrying in his veins the blood of the two nations, or two of the nations, I should say, of Canada, that is to say, Pierre Elliott Trudeau being of both English and French descent, and of course, Mr. Obama being of both African and European descent. And watching this documentary, I was struck over and over again by the parallels between the two gentlemen. And it seems to me that's something that some scholars should explore, or some journalists should explore.
I concur, because I've been reading Trudeau, and as you know, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, if you want to get slapped down, you can try to criticize Pierre Elliott Trudeau to new immigrants from the Caribbean or from Asia. However, I'm a type of person that I'll accept the challenge. And I think Pierre Elliott Trudeau, while he said at, Fidel Castro came to his funeral, he was very close to Fidel Castro. It was Pierre Elliott Trudeau who, enacted the enacted the War Act in Quebec, and he opposed U.S. imperialism. He basically was still supporting Canadian imperialism. That's how I see Mr. Trudeau. Although I do see him as probably the most independent prime minister this country has ever had. I mean, he did stand up to the Yankees for whatever reason. He did do that.
And I was also struck, since you mentioned some of the past transgressions of Mr. Trudeau, his response in Quebec to the rise of the FLQ and to the rise of nationalism as embodied in René Lévesque in particular. I mean, these men were jousting repeatedly, and it was quite striking to watch the old news footage, because René Lévesque in some ways was a foil for Mr. Trudeau, allowing Mr. Trudeau, it seems to me, a bit of running room to press on the question of bilingualism, which he seemed to do, at the same time giving a stiff arm and a cold shoulder to the idea of a separate Quebec nation.
Yeah, and the fact that you mentioned the fact that Trudeau had, the two bloods running through him, you are definitely hit something on the head, because Trudeau did not have First Nations blood, and this country is definitely English, French, as well as First Nations, although some people do not want to acknowledge the fact that this is, in fact, a settler colony, as well as the United States, Australia, and Rhodesia, South Africa, so on and so forth, Kenya, but we can talk about that at another time.
The point is well taken. That's why I caught myself and said two of the nations as opposed to two nations.
You definitely did catch yourself, and I was not trying to be an Oprah Winfrey, not trying to top you, but I just wanted to clarify that. The automobile crisis in North America and the world. Now, could you talk about that? Because this automobile crisis is affecting Canada, the United States, and it looks as if Canada is getting in bed with Italian imperialism, and there's all kind of inter-imperialist rivalry taking place. Could you give us some insight on the automobile crisis as it affects North America and the planet?
Well, first of all, part of the problem with regard to the automobile industry is the global financial downturn. And because of the fact that these bankers in particular are running roughshod over their balance sheets, we've seen a drop in global income, and people don't have enough money to buy new cars. And so therefore, fewer cars are being sold, and therefore fewer workers are needed to buy cars. And then in particular, to make cars, and in particular in the United States with General Motors, you have a situation whereby instead of national health care, you have a situation where the company itself was providing health care, and health care costs in this country are steadily skyrocketing since it's a pro a for-profit business. And as you well know, General Motors and Chrysler were spending more on healthcare than they were in buying steel. And this put them in a particular disadvantage when it came to competing with Toyota, Nissan, and even Volkswagen in Germany. So the long and short of it is that General Motors and Chrysler have gone into bankruptcy. Both are downsizing severely. They're closing plants. They're laying off workers. It's a very grim scenario, and I must say that many of us are disappointed with the response of the United Auto Workers here in the United States. They seem to be trying to accommodate themselves to this new reality as opposed to mobilizing their members and struggling against this new reality. All in all, it's really bad news.
Now, your current book that's coming out on the Mau Mau, what is the correct title, and could you talk about your the book on Indian African Americans? Not talk about it, but just give me the titles.
Well, the Kenya book is called Mau Mau in Harlem, The United States and the Liberation of Kenya. And it actually provides, as I think about it, the necessary backstory for trying to understand how a Kenyan American came to be president of the United States. This is intimately involved with that liberation struggle beginning, or at least accelerating, in the early 1950s and known to many as, quote, Mau Mau, unquote, known to others, of course, as the war led by the Land and Freedom Army. And the book on India is called The End of Empires, African Americans in India. And in some ways, these books intersect, because in the book on Kenya, one of the points that I'm keen to make is the heretofore neglected role of the South Asian or Indian community, particularly in Mombasa along the Indian Ocean coast. It's fair to say that this community was pivotal to the liberation struggle in Kenya, but I would argue heretofore have not gotten their due, at least by the historians.
Now, there was an Indian brother who was assassinated around the same time as Malcolm X in Kenya.
That's right.
I can't recall his name at the moment. It'll come to me.
So, as I recall.
Yeah, Poe is an Indian, Payagama Pinto, and he was killed around the same time that Malcolm was killed, and he was a supporter of the Mau Mau, and a big supporter of the Land and Freedom Army. Yes, and I think.
I talk quite a bit about Mokin Sang, who was, of course, a man who had roots in the Indian subcontinent, who in fact sort of commuted back and forth between India and Kenya, playing a pivotal role in the liberation struggle in India and in Kenya itself. He was, quite frankly, the leader of the trade union movement, but came under heavy manners by the colonial authorities, which led directly to the rise of Tom Mboya, who was of the Luo ethnic group and who was a close comrade of Barack Obama Sr. And Tom Mboya basically used this whole idea of airlifting Kenyan students to the United States to get education as a form of patronage and made sure that his Luo countrymen in the first place were airlifted to the United States. And in the first place, this included Barack Obama Sr. I also make the point, which might be irrelevant, but this is a sort of detail that readers should know, that on his way to the United States for the first time, Barack Obama Sr. stopped in Paris to confer with Irving Brown, who had known CIA connections. Now, you know, I'm just putting that out there. It's a known fact, at least a known fact now, that it's going to be in my book, and people or readers can make of it what they want.
Now, let us talk about Africa, South Africa, Zimbabwe. I see in the papers, Toronto Star today, there's a picture of Jacob Zuma, Mr. Mandela, and Ms. Michelle. And could you talk about South Africa and Zimbabwe as we speak? What's taking place there in June of 2009?
Well, with regard to Zimbabwe, the inclusive government has gotten off to a rocky start. That is to say, the government of the erstwhile ruling party, ZANU-PF, and the erstwhile opposition, the Movement for Democratic Change. Mr. Tsvangirai of the MDC is now prime minister. Mr. Mugabe is a president, although more than a ceremonial president. But listeners should take note of what I'm about to say. I think one of the main problems we may face in Zimbabwe is a revolt of the military, in which case both the MDC and ZANU-PF could find themselves, shall we say, irrelevant. There has been an extraordinary restiveness by younger military officers complaining about their dwindling paychecks, not obeying orders. And, you know, when you have military figures not obeying orders, you should perk up your ears immediately. And that's been happening quite frequently in Zimbabwe of late. Apparently, there was a long meeting with Mr. Mugabe and the military chiefs about this. But it seems to me, in some senses, the situation in Zimbabwe, I'm afraid, is made to order for some sort of revolt amongst the military, and it's unclear where that what that might lead to. With regard to South Africa, as you well know, Jacob Zuma has been elected as the new president of South Africa. This comes in the wake of his defeat of his erstwhile comrade, Thabo Mbeki, who was, as you know, sacked as president by the leadership of the ANC just about 7 or 8 months ago. Now, we were told at the time that there would be a lurch to the left by the ANC with Mr. Zuma coming into power, but he gave something amounted to a State of the Union address just the other day, and I didn't hear anything that signaled a lurch to the left. He basically talked about many of the same things that Mr. Mbeki had talked about. So I think for many outsiders, it leaves us rather puzzled and baffled.
Okay, now, could we talk about the Sri Lankan situation? What has been taking place in the U.S. with the Sri Lankan situation? A couple of days ago, the Sri Lankans supposedly had a delegation, I should say the Tamils of Sri Lanka, went to Ottawa and had 40,000 people. This is after, supposedly, their situation, they have been defeated militarily and some say politically, but they're still putting... could put 40,000 people in the streets of Ottawa. And I understand this, I'm going to make a big confession, but these Sri Lankan situation, there are people here in Toronto that I didn't know were Tamils, and I didn't know that they were from Sri Lanka for a long time until just recently. Now, since this battle has taken place, I mean, I've had to go back and do a lot of research on Sri Lanka. How do you see that?
Well, as you know more than most, Canada has one of the largest expatriate Sri Lankan communities in the world today, and that helps to shed light on the extraordinary mobilization in the streets of Toronto and in Ottawa in particular in recent months. Sri Lanka, for those who may not be familiar, is the teardrop-shaped island off the southern coast of India, a population of about 20 million. And for some years now, there has been a struggle involving the Tamil minority of about 12% of the population, struggling for national rights in particular, and some would say a Tamil homeland in the north in particular of this island. Well, what happened is that the current leadership, that it's fair to characterize as overwhelmingly Sinhalese, that is to say the majority, basically were able, at least shall we say temporarily, to defeat this liberation movement and basically eliminate its leadership. Now, what I find striking about this turn of events that's just occurred within the last few weeks is that the leadership of Sri Lanka basically was receiving international support, not only from Pakistan and not only from China, and I'm speaking not only in the diplomatic sense but in the military sense, but it's probably fair to say that they were receiving support from India as well, because the Indians, New Delhi in particular, basically blamed the Tamil Liberation Tigers and their leadership for the unfortunate and tragic assassination of the son of Indira Gandhi, that is to say, Rahul Gandhi.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Rajiv Gandhi. Rahul is his son, who might become the next prime minister.
Right. Rajiv is the one that was assassinated, right?
Exactly. And, of course, the Tamils deny that they had a role in that, but the Indians seem to think otherwise. And if I were to be writing an autopsy of what happened in Sri Lanka, I would have to point to this extraordinary circumstance where you had these three key neighbors, Pakistan, India, and China, who have quarreled bitterly amongst themselves. We all know about the war that China and India fought in 1962 and the numerous wars that have been fought between Pakistan and India. But you would think that was a situation that was made to order for the Tamil Tigers to be able to at least get the support of one or at least two of those powers, but apparently that did not take place. I'll be very interested to hear what the Tamil community in Toronto has to say about that particular point.
We're going to try to get some I'm going to try to get some information out to you, and we could discuss that in detail the next time that we talk. But it's about time for us to wrap up very shortly. I wanted to get your thoughts on the Tiananmen Square situation. There's a lot of propaganda about that in the Canadian press. And Stephen Lewis was here the other night, and he attacked China, and he attacked Robert Mugabe, and he held up the African woman as usual. China seems to be under severe attack, and some of the criticism, in my judgment, is uncalled for. And secondly, how do you see the whole question of North Korea and their nuclear energy, nuclear capacity? Because I think that probably the only people on the planet Earth that don't have a bomb or nuclear weapons is probably Africans. And I don't know, we had that in South Africa, but when the ANC came to power, I guess they were forced to get rid of their nuclear arsenal. But everybody else in the world, with the exception of the Africans, maybe the Latin Americans, don't have any nuclear weapons. So could you talk about China and North Korea?
Well, with regard to China, it's extraordinarily complicated. You may recall that on June 4th, 1989, when this tragic circumstance took place, I happened to be in East Berlin. And this is a few months before the fall of the Berlin Wall, which I have to confess I did not anticipate. And when I heard the news about Tiananmen Square, which came on the same day, by the way, that the Solidarity-backed forces in Poland made a rather significant electoral advance against the ruling communists, I have to say that I was thinking that the rule of the communists, not only in Poland but in China, might not be long for this world, but not for the first time, and certainly not for the last time. I was proven incorrect. I was proven false. I say that the situation with China is extraordinarily complicated because, as we all know, China has basically vaulted itself into the front rank of nations, not least because it collaborated with U.S. imperialism in helping to bring down the former Soviet Union. But in the process, U.S. imperialism has incurred an staggering, an enormous amount of debt to China. And that is the present dilemma that the U.S. and its economic depression or recession, depending on what term you want to use, faces, that it has so much debt that it owes to China. And so ringing the bell about Tiananmen Square, I don't really see that as a sincere interest in human rights, as some would have it. I basically see it as a way to gain leverage against China as these two powers struggle for leverage against one another. Now, with regard to North Korea, as we know, there was a treaty that was inked some time ago, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, that basically had two aspects. The existing nuclear powers, the United States in the first place, would seek to reduce their nuclear tonnage, and in return, non-nuclear states would not take on nuclear weapons. Now, we all know that point A of that Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty has not been adhered to. Instead of reducing its nuclear tonnage, the United States has built up its nuclear tonnage, and it seems to me that nations like North Korea, as they look around the world and as they see that Iraq was overthrown and it did not have nuclear weapons, and threats are now being made against Iran because there is a fear that it will get nuclear weapons, and it's known that if they do, there will be no probable invasion of Iran. It seems to me that in order to preserve its regime, the Pyongyang government is trying to develop nuclear weapons. And I might also say, according to some analysts, that as North Korea sees it with the United States in this severe economic downturn, this is an opportunity to put pressure on the United States. In other words, we're accustomed to U.S. imperialism putting pressure on other nations. Well, with this economic downturn, we're seeing the script flipped, and we're seeing other nations putting pressure on U.S. imperialism. I also saw that at the meeting in Honduras of the Organization of American States, where it was basically voted that Cuba should be readmitted to the Organization of American States after being unceremoniously ousted in 1962. This was another example of putting pressure on Washington to adjust to the new global realities. And that is the context, it seems to me, through which we should view what's going on in the Korean Peninsula.
This is the last question. This is Black Music Month, June, and the President of the United States, Barack Obama, has not, and it looks like he's not going to issue a proclamation. This is the 30th anniversary of Black Music Month. He has, the Caribbean community has forced him to make a statement, a proclamation of Caribbean American Heritage Month, which is the same month as June. I think Bush did that. And I was reading in the papers, reading online, how someone is trying to say that the Republican Party is more progressive than the Democratic Party on the question of Black music because, you know, what Barack Obama is doing with Black music. I know that Obama has had Stevie Wonder in the White House, Earth, Wind, and Fire, Sweet Honey in the Rock, I believe. But what is your assessment of why Mr. Obama is not doing anything for the 30th anniversary of Black Music Month, which was began by Kenneth Gamble, who is a Muslim. His Muslim name, his Islamic name is Muhammad Luqman. So Mr. Luqman, who is, I guess, a good standing Muslim, and Barack Obama being a great son of a Muslim, you know, why is it that he is, why do you feel he's not dealing with Black Music Month?
Well, I'm rather surprised by that, I must say, because it's well known that he is a devotee of Black music, as exemplified by those guests who you correctly note have been invited to the White House, not only for performances, but for honors. But in this backwards, retrograde, reactionary atmosphere in the United States, the right wing is continuously looking and searching and hoping for signs that they can point to that shows that President Obama is a secret Black nationalist and that he only cares about Black people and he doesn't like anybody but Black people, which is, of course, obviously stupendously ridiculous. But let's face it, when you have a backwards electorate, that is to say a significant part of the electorate that happens to be of European descent, I must say, that is backwards, well, they tend to fall for anything. So that context might help to explain this extraordinary decision, if that is what it is, by Mr. Obama, although I must say that it is one more disappointment that I'll have to chalk up.
Now, we are going to end this in conversation with, we're going to be playing music from Eric Allen Dolphy, a brother that had Panamanian roots. We're going to be playing God Bless the Child, which is Eric Dolphy playing his bass clarinet, doing a solo performance. What are your thoughts on Eric Allen Dolphy?
Well, you know, I have a certain fondness for him, as I have fondness for anybody who has roots in Los Angeles, a city where I've spent quite a pleasant moment. And I think that when he was taken from us so tragically and so prematurely, it was a blow to the music. It was a blow to the kind of music that, of course, we associate with John Coltrane. But I think that when a more balanced history of that era is written, I think we'll find that Eric Dolphy will deserve certainly more than a footnote, and certainly he needs to be better known than he is today.
This is the last thing. I don't know if you ever knew this, but Eric Dolphy's parents, or Eric Dolphy's mother, gave John Coltrane Eric Dolphy's instruments. And I saw John Coltrane once. I saw Coltrane many times, but one time I went to a club called the It Club in Los Angeles, which was owned by a Black man. And Eric Dolphy, not Eric Dolphy, but John Coltrane was in the corner playing the bass clarinet, and I was scratching my head. There was no one in the club. And I walked over to McCoy Tyner and asked him what had happened. He said that McCoy said that, you know, no one had showed up at the club. So Train was in the corner playing this bass clarinet. And I found out years later that Eric Dolphy's mother had given Coltrane his instruments. So I imagine that was in right after Eric passed away. And I guess Dolphy was playing on the bass clarinet that Miss Dolphy had given to John William Coltrane.
Extraordinary.
All right, so thank you, my friend. We're going to end this session with God Bless the Child with Eric Allen Dolphy. And thank you. We'll talk to you next very soon.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right.